I want to welcome you all to the 13th Annual Barbara Olson Memorial Lecture. I am Eugene Meyer, President of the Federalist Society, and this Memorial Lecture series started, as many of you know, with Ted Olson's inaugural lecture, which reminded us of what it means to be an American and how our legal tradition is part of our identity as Americans. Both Ted and Barbara understood this connection between our tradition and our identity. We want the lecture series to remind lawyers of it so that they foster legal principles that advance individual freedom, personal responsibility, and the rule of law. Ted's inaugural lecture was followed by Ken Starr, Robert Bork, Justice Scalia, Judge Randolph, Vice President Cheney, and Chief Justice Roberts, and Judges Edith Jones, Douglas Ginsburg, and Dennis Jacobs, former Attorney General Michael Mukasey, and entrepreneur Peter Thiel. That brings us to today's lecture. It's my honor to introduce for today's lecture the Honorable Neil Gorsuch, who's a judge for the U.S. Court of Appeals on the 10th Circuit, where he served since 1986. Before his clerkship, before his judgeship, rather, he clerked. Yeah, well, the way clerkship applications are, and things are going these days, you have no idea what the order is going to be. I actually think they're going to send out the clerkship applications or with the admissions to law school, the way it's going. But anyway, before his clerkship, he clerked for Justices White and Kennedy and on the Court of Appeals for Judge Sentell. He was a partner at Kellogg Huber and Principal Deputy Associate Attorney General. In addition to his judgeship, he is also currently an adjunct law professor at the University of Colorado, where he taught yesterday, actually I think yesterday evening. And I'd say beyond his paper resume, Judge Gorsuch is widely viewed as one of the best legal minds of his generation. Additionally, even at his young age, he has mentored many of his clerks who've gone on to many prestigious legal jobs, including clerkship for the U.S. Supreme Court. Without further ado, it is my honor to introduce to you Judge Neil Gorsuch.
Actually, Gene, with judicial salaries being what they are and clerkship bonuses what they've become, I've been more than tempted to throw in another application to Justice Kennedy, see where it goes. I'm not sure I want to be a law partner again, but I wouldn't mind being put in a little room and told to write briefs all day for the price that they're getting paid. Anyway, thank you for that very kind introduction. It's an honor to be with you, and a special pleasure to be part of a lecture series dedicated to the memory of Barbara Olson and to the causes that she held dear, the rule of law, limited government, and human liberty. And it's not a little bit daunting to be added to the list of folks you've mentioned who've given this talk before. Let me begin by asking whether any of you have ever suffered through a case that sounds like this one. In the course of time, this suit has become so complicated that no man alive knows what it means. A long procession of judges has come in and gone out. The legion of bills in the suit have become transformed into mere bills of mortality. But still, it drags its dreary length before the court, perennially hopeless. How familiar does that sound? Could it be a line lifted maybe from a speaker at a recent electronic discovery conference? From a brief for sanctions in your latest case? Maybe from a recent judicial performance complaint? Well, of course, the line comes from Dickens, Bleak House, published 1853. It still resonates today, though, because the law's promise of deliberation and due process sometimes, ironically, invites the injustices of delay and irresolution. Like any human enterprise, the law's crooked timber occasionally produces the opposite of the intended effect. We turn to the law earnestly to promote a worthy idea and wind up with a host of unwelcome side effects that do more harm than good. In fact, when you think about it, the whole business is something of an irony. We depend upon the rule of law to guarantee freedom, but we have to give up freedom to live under the law's rules. And in a roundabout way, that leads me to the topic I'd like to discuss with you tonight, law's irony. Dickens had a keen eye for it, but even he was only reworking familiar themes. Hamlet rued the law's delay. Goethe left the practice of law in disgust after witnessing thousands of aging cases waiting vainly for resolution in the courts of his time. Demosthenes made similar complaints 2,000 years ago. And truth is, I fully expect lawyers and judges to carry on similar conversations about the law's ironies 2,000 years from now. But just because some unwelcome ironies may be as endemic to law as they are to life, Dickens would remind us that's hardly reason to let them go unremarked and unaddressed. So it is, I'd like to begin by discussing a few of the law's ironies that I imagine he would consider worthy of attention by us in our own time. Consider first our version of the Bleak House irony. Yes, I'm referring to civil discovery. The adoption of the modern rules of civil procedure in 1938 marked the start of a self-proclaimed experiment with expansive pretrial discovery, something previously unknown to the federal courts. More than 70 years later, we still call those rules the new and the modern rules of civil procedure. Now, that's a pretty odd thing when you think about it. Maybe the only thing that really sounds new or modern after 70 years is Keith Richards of the Rolling Stones. And some might say, looks like he's done some experimenting too. In any event, our 1938 forefathers expressly rested their modern discovery experiment on the assumption that with ready access to an opponent's information, parties to civil disputes would achieve fairer and cheaper merits-based resolutions. How's that working out for you? Does modern discovery practice really lead to faster and more efficient resolutions based on the merits? I don't doubt it does in many cases, but should we be concerned when 80% of the American College of Trial Lawyers say that discovery costs and delays keep injured parties from bringing valid claims to court? Or concerned when 70% also say attorneys use discovery costs as a threat to force settlements that aren't merits-based at all? Have we maybe gone so far down the road of civil discovery that, ironically enough, we've begun to undermine the purposes that animated our journey in the first place? What we have today, to be sure, is not your father's discovery. Producing discovery anymore doesn't mean rolling a stack of bankers' boxes across the street. We live in an age when every bit and byte of information is stored seemingly forever and is always retrievable, if sometimes only at the cost of a small fortune. Today, the world sends 50 trillion emails a year. An average employee sends or receives over 100 every day. That doesn't begin to count the billions of instant messages shooting around the globe. This isn't a world the writers of the discovery rules could have imagined in 1938, no matter how modern they were. No surprise, then, that many people now simply opt out of the civil justice system altogether. Private ADR abounds. But even now, the federal government has begun avoiding its own court system. Recently, for example, it opted for private ADR to handle claims arising from the BP oil spill. Now, that may be an understandable development given the costs and delays inherent in modern civil practice, but it raises questions, too, about the transparency and independence of the decision-making, the lack of the development of precedent, and the future role of our courts in civic life. For a society aspiring to live under the rule of law, does this represent an advance or perhaps something else? We might even ask what part the rise of discovery has played in the demise of the trial. Surely other factors are at play here, given the disappearance of criminal trials as well. But we've now trained generations of attorneys as discovery artists rather than trial lawyers. They're skilled in the game of imposing and evading costs and delays. They're poets of the nasty gram, able to write interrogatories in iambic pentameter, yet terrified of trial. The founders thought trials were a bulwark of the rule of law. As far as Hamilton saw it, the only room for debate was over whether jury trials were, and in his words, either a valuable safeguard to liberty or the very palladium of self-government. But is that still common ground today? No doubt our modern discovery experiment is well-intentioned, yet one of its effects has been to contribute to the death of an institution once thought essential to the rule of law. What about our criminal justice system, you might ask? It surely bears its share of ironies, too. Consider this one. Without question, the discipline of writing the law down, of codifying it, advances the law's interest in fair notice. But today, we have about 5,000 federal criminal statutes on the books, most of them added in the last few decades. And the spigot keeps pouring, with literally hundreds of new statutory crimes inked every single year. Neither does that begin to count the thousands of additional regulatory crimes buried in the Federal Register. There are so many crimes cowled in the numbing fine print of those pages that scholars have given up counting and are now debating their number. When he led the Senate Judiciary Committee, Joe Biden worried that we have assumed a tendency to federalize, quote, everything that walks, talks, and moves. Maybe we should say hoots, too. Because it's now a federal crime to misuse the likeness of Woodsy the Owl. Or his immortal words, give a hoot, don't pollute. Businessmen who import lobster tails in plastic bags rather than cardboard boxes can be brought up on charges. Mattress sellers who remove that little tag? Yes, they're probably federal criminals too. Whether because of public choice problems or otherwise, there appears to be a ratchet relentlessly clicking away, always in the direction of more, never fewer, federal criminal laws. Some reply that the growing number of federal crimes isn't out of proportion to our population and its growth. Others suggest that the proliferation of federal criminal laws can be mitigated by allowing the mistake of law defense to be more widely asserted. But isn't there a trouble irony lurking here in any event? Without written laws, we lack fair notice of the rules we as citizens have to obey. But with too many written laws, don't we invite a new kind of fair notice problem? And what happens to individual freedom and equality when the criminal law comes to cover so many facets of daily life that prosecutors can almost choose their targets with impunity? The sort of excesses of executive authority invited by too few written laws led to the rebellion against King John and the sealing of the Magna Carta, one of the great advances in the rule of law. But history bears warning that too much inaccessible law can lead to executive excess as well. Caligula sought to protect his authority by publishing the law in a hand so small and posted so high that no one could really be sure what was and wasn't forbidden. No doubt, all the better to keep us on our toes. Sorry. In Federalist 62, more seriously, Madison warned that when laws become just a paper blizzard, citizens are left unable to know what the law is and to conform their conduct to it. It's an irony of the law that either too much or too little can impair liberty. Our aim here has to be for a golden mean, and it may be worth asking today if we've strayed too far from it. Okay, beyond the law itself, there are other ironies. Ironies here emanating from our law schools. A target-rich environment, you say? Well, let's be kind to the professors in the room and just take one example. In our zeal for high academic standards, we have developed a dreary bill of particulars every law school must satisfy to win ABA accreditation. Law schools must employ a full-time librarian. They're not a part-timer. They must provide extensive tenure guarantees. They invite trouble if their student-faculty ratio reaches 30 to 1, about the same ratio found in many in public parochial schools. Keep in mind, too, that under ABA standards, adjunct professors with actual practice experience, that includes me, here count only as one-fifth of an instructor. Maybe they're onto something after all. Might it be worth pausing to ask whether commands like these contribute enough to learning to justify the barriers to entry and the limits on access to justice that they impose? A legal education can cost students today $200,000. That's on top of an equally swollen sum for an undergraduate degree, yet another ABA accreditation requirement. In England, students can earn a law degree in 3 years as undergraduates, or in 1 year of study after college, all of which must be followed by on-the-job training. And none of this is thought to be a threat to the rule of law there. One might wonder whether the sort of expensive and extensive homogeneity we demand is essential to the rule of law here. All right, so far I've visited ironies where the law aims at one virtue and risks a corresponding vice. But it seems to me that the law's most remarkable irony today comes from precisely the opposite direction, a vice that hints at virtues in the rule of law. Today, our culture positively buzzes with cynicism about the law, our shared profession and project. So many see law as the work of robed hacks and shiny suited shills, judges who rule by personal policy preference, lawyers who seek to razzle-dazzle them. On this view, the only rule of law is the will to power. Maybe in a dark moment you've fallen prey to doubts along these lines yourself. But I wonder whether the law's greatest irony might just be the hope obscured by the cynic's shadow. I wonder whether cynicism about the law flourishes so freely only because, for all its blemishes, the rule of law in our society is so fundamentally successful that sometimes it's hard to see. I wonder if we're like David Foster Wallace's fish, surrounded by water, yet somehow unable to appreciate its existence. Or like Chesterton's man on the street, who's asked out of the blue why he prefers civilization to barbarism, and who has a hard time stammering out a reply because the very multiplicity of proof, which should make reply easy and overwhelming, makes it impossible. Now, the cynicism surrounding our project, our profession, is easy enough to see. When Supreme Court justices try to defend law as a discipline, when they explain their jobs as interpreting legal texts, when they evoke and echo the traditional Federalist 78 conception of a good judge, they're mocked, often viciously and personally. Leading media voices call them deceiving, warn that behind their benign beige facades lurk crimson partisans. Even law professors hurry to the microphone to express complete disgust and accuse them of perjury and intellectual vacuity. Actual quotes, everyone. If this bleak picture I've sketched were an accurate one, if I believed that judges and lawyers regularly acted as shills and hacks, I'd hang up the robe. I'd turn in my license. But even accounting for my native optimism, I just don't think that's what a life in the law is about. And at heart, I doubt you do either. As a working lawyer, I saw time and again that creativity, intelligence, hard work applied to a legal problem could make a profound difference in a client's life. I saw judges and juries that, while human and imperfect, strove to hear earnestly and decide impartially. I never felt my arguments to courts were political ones, but ones based on rules of procedure and evidence, precedent, standard interpretive techniques. The prosaic but vital stuff of a life in the law. As a judge now for 7 whatever years, I see colleagues every day striving to enforce the Constitution, the statutes passed by Congress, the precedents that bind us, the contracts the parties have adopted. Sometimes they do so with quiet misgivings about the wisdom of the regulation at issue, sometimes with concern about their complicity in a doubtful statute, but enforcing the law all the same, believers that ours is essentially a just legal order. Now, that's not to suggest that we lawyers and judges bear no blame for our age's cynicism about the law. Take our self-adopted model rules of professional conduct. They explain that the duty of diligence we lawyers owe our clients, and I quote, does not require the use of offensive tactics or preclude treating people with courtesy and respect. Now, how's that for a professional promise to the public? I view it as sort of an ethical commandment, as I tell my students, that as a lawyer, you should do unto others before they can do unto you. No doubt, we have to look hard in the mirror when our profession's reflected image in popular culture is no longer Atticus Finch, but Saul Goodman. Of course, we make our share of mistakes, too, As my now teenage daughters gleefully remind me, donning a robe does not make me any smarter. But the robe does mean something, and not just that I can hide the coffee stains on my shirt. It serves as a reminder of what's expected of us, what Burke called the cold neutrality of an impartial judge. It serves, too, as a reminder of the relatively modest station we as judges are meant to occupy in a democratic society. In other places, judges wear scarlet and ermine. Here we're told to buy our own robes. And I can attest the standard choir outfit at the local uniform supply store is a really good deal. Ours is a judiciary of honest black polyester. In defending law as a coherent discipline now, I don't mean to suggest that every hard legal question has a single right answer, that some platonic form or absolute truth exists for every crazy, naughty statute or royal regulation, if only you possess superhuman power to discern it. I don't know about you, but I haven't met many judges who resemble some sort of legal Hercules. Well, maybe my old boss, Byron White. But how many of us are going to lead the NFL in rushing? When a lawyer claims absolute metaphysical certainty about the meaning of some chain of ungrammatical prepositional phrases tacked onto the end of a run-on sentence buried in some sprawling statutory subsection, I start worrying. For questions like those, my only gospel is skepticism, though I try not to make a dogma out of it. But to admit that disagreement does and will always exist over hard and fine questions of law like that doesn't mean our disagreements are matters of personal will or politics rather than an honest effort of making sense of the legal materials at hand. The very first case I wrote for the Tenth Circuit to reach the United States Supreme Court involved a close question of statutory construction, and the court split 5-4. Justice Breyer wrote to affirm. He was joined by Justices Thomas, Ginsburg, Alito, and Sotomayor. Chief Justice Roberts dissented, and he was joined by Justices Stevens and Scalia and Kennedy. Now, that's a lineup that the public doesn't often hear about, but it's the sort of thing that happens quietly, day in and day out, in courts throughout our country. As you know, but the legal cynic overlooks, the vast majority of disputes coming to our courts are ones in which all judges agree on the outcome. The intense focus on the few cases where we disagree suffers from a serious selection effect problem. Over 90% of the decisions issued by my court are unanimous, and that's pretty typical of the federal appellate courts. 40% of the Supreme Court's cases are unanimous too, even though they face the toughest assignments, and 9, not 3, judges have to vote in every single dispute. In fact, the Supreme Court's rate of dissent has been largely stable for 70 years. You don't hear that. This despite the fact that back in 1945, 8 of the 9 justices had been appointed by a single president, and today's sitting justices were appointed by 5 different presidents. Even in those few cases where we do disagree, the cynic also fails to appreciate the nature of our disagreement. We lawyers and judges may dispute which tools of legal analysis are most appropriate for ascertaining a statute's meaning. We may disagree over the order of priority we should assign to competing tools and their consonance with the Constitution. We may even disagree over the results our agreed tools yield in particular cases. These disagreements sometimes produce familiar lineups, but sometimes not. Consider, for example, the debates between Justice Scalia and Thomas over the role of the rule of lenity, or their disagreements about the degree of deference due precedent, or some of the debates you've heard today between and among textualists and originalists. These debates are hugely consequential, vital, but they're disputes of legal judgment, not disputes about politics or personal will. In the hardest cases as well, many constraints narrow the realm of admissible dispute. Closed factual records, an adversarial process where parties, not courts, usually determine the issues for decision. Standards of review that command deference to finders of fact. The rules requiring us appellate judges to operate in collegial panels where we listen and learn from one another. The discipline of writing reason-giving opinions and the possibility of further review. Now, to be sure, these constraints sometimes point in different directions. I'm not advocating a single right answer to every problem, but that shouldn't obscure how those tools, those constraints, often serve to limit the latitude available to all judges, even the cynics imagine judge who like nothing more than imposes policy preferences on everyone else. And on top of all that, what today appears to be a hard case, tomorrow becomes an easy one, an accretion to precedent as a new constraint on the range of legally available options in future cases. Now maybe I do exaggerate the cynicism that seems to pervade today. Or maybe the cynicism I see is real, but endemic to every place and every time. And it seems something fresh only because this is our place and our time. After all, lawyers and judges have never been much loved. Shakespeare wrote the history of King Henry VI in three parts. And in all of those three plays, there's only a single joke. Jack Cade and his followers come to London, intent on rebellion. And they offer as their first rallying cry, "Let's kill all the lawyers." As in fact, they pretty much did. But maybe, just maybe, the cynicism about the rule of law, whatever the place, whatever the time, is its greatest irony. Maybe the cynicism is so apparent in our society only because the rule of law here, for all its problems, is so successful. After all, who can make so much fun of the law without being very sure the law makes it safe to do so? Don't our friends, our neighbors, and we ourselves expect and demand, not just hope for, justice based on the rule of law? Our country today shoulders an enormous burden. It's the most powerful nation on earth, the most obvious example of a people struggling to govern itself under the rule of law. Our mistakes and our missteps are heralded by those who do not wish us well. They're easy enough to see even by those who do. Neither should we try to shuffle our problems under the rug. We have far too many to ignore today. The fact is, the law can be a messy human business, a disappointment to those seeking truth in some absolute sense and expecting more of the divine or heroic from those of us wearing the robes. And it's easy enough to spot examples where the law's ironies are truly bitter. But it seems to me that we shouldn't dwell so much on the bitter that we never savor the sweet. It is, after all, our shared profession to which we've devoted our professional lives, the law, that permits us to resolve our disputes without resort to violence, to organize our affairs with some measure of confidence. It is through the careful application of the law's existing premises that we're able to adapt and generate new solutions to changing social coordination problems as they emerge. And when done well, the law permits us to achieve all this in a deliberative, non-discriminatory, and transparent way. Those are no small things. Here, then, is the irony I'd like to leave you with tonight. If sometimes the cynic in all of us fails to see our nation's successes when it comes to the rule of law, maybe it's because we're like David Foster Wallace's fish, who's oblivious to life-giving water in which it swims. Maybe we overlook our nation's success in living under the rule of law only because, for all our faults, that success is so obvious it's sometimes hard to see. Thank you.